Marilyn Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 18, delivered on October 24th.
Today, the capital asset pricing model, CAPM. Before I begin, just a few announcements. I'll be giving a couple of surprise quizzes over the next week. And for heaven's sakes, don't write to me, when are the quizzes? And also, the event that I had announced on Tuesday has been rescheduled for November the 7th. So the Dress for Success is on the 7th of November, not tomorrow, not tonight. Now, a quick look at the numbers here for a while. If you're going to have a look at markets that are kind of confusing, you get no better than what we have right now. As far as the markets are concerned, you can see that we have the NASDAQ is actually performing pretty well today, up more than six tenths of a percent, but the S&P 500 is just barely up, and the Dow is down. So whatever good news is out there is most significantly affecting small cap stocks. The large caps are doing a little bit, getting a little benefit, and the largest companies are not getting any benefit at all. They're in a bad mood today. It's not terrible, but it's just one of those days that's a little difficult to determine. But if we look over here at the 10-year bond, you do see that the price, the index of 10-year bonds is going down. Price going down, yields are going up, which indicates, of course, that there is movement out of bonds, and at least some of that beneficiary is gold, obviously enough, but there's also some buying in the NASDAQ. If you would look at it, though, well, we're about at the midday right now. We're coming up on the midday. So, and you see that it is very slow trading, even on the NASDAQ, where the price, where the index is going up quite a bit. It's still pretty slow trading for the day. Moving from that, however, there's not a lot you can say about a day like this, other than that it is just a day. Oh, let me bring up something real quick here. I'm just going to pull a stock out at random, something, I don't know. Look at a Kellogg's. I want to go to finance. And looking at Kellogg, for example, I've been talking about this thing right here, beta, over and over again. This beta measures the risk of a stock relative to the market portfolio. That, I just keep going over that as the primary measure of risk that we have in our way of doing things in finance. Now, other ones are also kind of useful. This is the price-earnings ratio. Below 30 indicates a fairly low-risk stock. And if we see a stock like, for example, NVDA, NVIDIA, you'll see that that has a very high beta, 2.47. And that means that it is in a portfolio. Its volatility would be 247% of the markets. And you see that the price-earnings ratio is confirming that. Now, going to another one, let me look at AMD, just out of curiosity. Gee, look at this. Extraordinarily high beta and a very high P.E. ratio. This would be almost, obviously, a sell. Overvalued, but there's this recommendation to buy it, even though the price-earnings ratio is already through the roof on it, and the beta is extraordinarily high, which means it's a high-risk stock. Moving to something that's a little bit more sane, for example, like, oh, I,
CVS. I haven't even looked at that. That P-E ratio is actually a little low for the beta. But let me show you something real quick here. AGG, it's a mutual fund. And it's a bond mutual fund. It is a highly diversified. As a matter of fact, it is so diversified that it's considered a benchmark. In other words, we use this, the performance of this index, to measure other bonds. And then unsurprisingly, notice that its beta is 1.00. It is exactly the risk of a market portfolio. However, it's a bond fund. It's a bond fund. There's another one here too, and I'm trying to remember. I am not going to remember the name. This. Higher than the bond market portfolio. This is an ETF. It's also, interestingly enough, something of an index, although this is a risky index. And it's just been taking a bath this year so far, year to date. But I'm trying to remember, what was the one? Oh, SP, the spider. The spider is a stock, an index of the S&P 500. Notice that the spider has a beta of exactly the market portfolio. Again, this is a benchmark. So in other words, when you're comparing your performance against the market and you're an equities investor, you would look at the spider as a reference point. On the other hand, if you were a bond investor, you would look at the performance of yours against AGG as your benchmark. This is why the beta has so many uses, and you're going to see what it is all about today. But to start this off, you're wearing a tie today, so I will ask you, sir, do you exercise? Do you even let you? Yeah, okay. If you exercise, I'm sure you do. Okay. So the thing about exercise that reveals a principle of the universe. If you start with one today,
one push-up, starter,
Okay, tomorrow you do two.
Well, that didn't bother me at all. Going 100% up from one to two.
You actually, it didn't feel anything at all. But now you're doing 100, and you've got to do that 100 first. And you will, I poured something. Okay. You see, that only a 1% movement from 100 to 101 is a killer. This is a principle that in economics is called the law of diminishing productivity. However, it is pervasive through physics and even chemistry. The more you push a system, the less marginal you get out of it. But an interesting thing about the way the physical universe works is that we see this kind of principle shown all over the place. Long, long time ago, the Environmental Protection Agency started saying, we want an average fuel efficiency on your cars, car manufacturers, of this. You could have some that was over it, some that was under it, but you had to have an overall average fuel efficiency of something like 18 miles to the gallon. And then every so often, the EPA upped the standard. We want to see it up to 19, to 21, to 25. Now, at first, the car manufacturers, they bitched about it, but it wasn't that hard to do. You just use somewhat lighter weight components. You start replacing metals with plastics. You make the engines have better tolerances, tighter tolerances, so that no fuel gets out, etc.
wasn't that hard. But as time went on, it got harder and harder to meet the new fuel efficiency standards as they went up. Car companies went to all kinds of things. They went to a completely different form. Now most cars are shaped like upside down jelly beans. They're just these sloping things. They have none of those decorative surfaces old cars did, like the tail wings and stuff like that. They even, at this point, they don't even use the same paint technology. It used to be a paint was nice and thick, so that if you got a scratch, you could just rub it out. Now you can't do that on these new cars because literally the paint is microns thick, just to save a little bit of weight in the beast. There's that again. It's getting harder and harder to reach new fuel efficiency standards. What does that mean here? In stocks, I'm going to draw. And this is actually been done. You can find pictures of this all over Google. You type in these certain words, and you'll see the graphs of this. Some of them are, like just theoretical. Others are actually data that has been collected. Huge amounts of data revealing this. If you were to start thinking, all right, let's take individual stocks and portfolios. You got a stock really is a portfolio fund. And let's plot their risk, and we'll measure that by standard deviation, which is easy to do in Excel, against the returns that these stocks are getting. Now, literally, I would say probably hundreds of dissertations were written about it back in the day, and researchers did it over and over again. And they would, okay, here is a little portfolio. It's risk versus return. Okay, now we've got, here's a higher risk portfolio. Okay, we got a stock that's up here, and a portfolio of a couple of stocks here, and some stocks here. Here's a portfolio. Here's a portfolio. Here's a portfolio. And you start plotting these. And literally, like I said, you can do this. You can Google for images, and you will see these little graphs. And the ones that are impressive are the ones that have actually been collected from data on thousands of portfolios. And as you plot the different points, you build up this map. And it has, no matter how many times you do it, no matter how many stocks, portfolios of stocks and bonds, et cetera, ETFs, mutual funds, no matter, you just try to load it with everything you can just to see where risk and return comes out on each of these portfolios. And something over up here, if you do a lot of these, hundreds, or thousands in some cases. I think I read one guy who wrote a dissertation actually did close to 10,000 different portfolios and individual stocks, mutual funds, ETFs, and they plotted them. And something always emerges. Something that we've seen in physics and engineering as well emerges. The same curiosity. There are all of these data points that get collected, but they never ever go into a white space. There's a white space there. And this, like I said, I mean car performance, no matter how you tweak the engine, no matter how you, what you do, there's only ever, no car can exceed a certain place. No rocket can exceed a certain speed. No star can burn at above a certain brightness based upon its size. This thing forms what we call in mathematics. It's called an envelope. It's, and that there was an old term, pushing the envelope, which had to do with, is there a way to move that up? No. It's there, and it sits there, and it's very obvious. It's really obvious. No matter how hard you try, no matter how much intelligence you have about stock markets and all that, you cannot create any portfolio that is up above that envelope. It's called, in general, it's called a performance envelope. In finance, we call it the frontier of efficient investments. Now, you can Google that. You just type in this term here and go to images, and you'll see this. But it's all, as a matter of fact, one of my graphs, I should say, from long ago when I was writing about this, it was there a few years ago. I don't know if it's still there or not. But there you go. In other words, okay, you could, for example, for a certain risk level, buy this portfolio and that stock. But there's actually a more efficient portfolio that has the same risk but a better return. And there is probably something that's even more efficient. In other words, for the same risk, you can get, afford the same risk, you can get an even better return. Take it the other way, okay, I can afford this return, I can take this risk, this risk, this risk, this risk, or that risk. Well, obviously, I don't want to take any more risk than I have to. So I would want to make a portfolio that got as close this way. I have an expected return in my mind, let's say 8%. Okay, I can get a portfolio with huge risk that gives me 8%. Or I can take a portfolio that has a considerably lesser risk that gets me the same return. This is the theory and practice, and responsible practice, I should say, of investing. Let me show you an example. And I'm kind of estimating this right here. This is, with respect to this investment space, that right there is about where a single stock called MSFT sits, Microsoft. It sits, if you buy the stock on its own, it sits well inside the frontier. In other words, there is a, this is the total risk, sigma of MFST. But that risk has two pieces to it. There's a risk that you're taking on that you don't need to. There's a risk there. You could get a portfolio that will give you the same return as Microsoft, but with a lot less risk. So this risk right here, we call unsystematic risk. Now, your book has some odd terms for it. One of those terms that I've seen before, it's not all that common, they call it company risk. This is a risk that is just Microsoft's risk. It's not, and then this other risk here, you can't get that out. You cannot find a portfolio that gives you this return that doesn't have this piece in it. You get right on the efficient frontier, and you got that problem. That is called the systematic risk, because it's in the system. Systematic risk. Now, keep this in your notes, and I'm going to give you two other names for this in just a little bit. But for right now, buying a single stock, any single stock you buy would be way in soft. By diversifying your portfolio, you can get the same return with a lot less risk, because buying more stocks allows you to get rid of this unsystematic risk. Think of it this way. I'll do it somewhere. Okay.
You deserve this. You're wearing fur today. Is that fake fur? Okay, well, I think it's moving, so it's still alive. Okay. I need to tell you this, ma'am, but you have a medical issue. Okay, now, this, you have a nodule on your nose. It's sitting here like this. Now, I can cut that out. That I can get rid of, okay? It's gone. You're okay. Because it wasn't in your system. Now, however, it turns out, you ever seen the movie Alien? You know, with the thing that Now, I had that when I had something that was a little too spicy in Central America. But, okay, that's in your system. I can't cut it out. I go in there and try to cut it out, it bites my hand. You die. That's systematic. I can't get it out of it. You see, one of the things in medical science, putting it in rather blunt terms, we are, many of our technologies are trying to find ways to turn systematic problems into unsystematic things that we can't get rid of. However, we know that there are some things that just ain't gonna happen. But anyway, this is the efficient frontier. Up here, you see up here, these would be called efficient, anything that actually sat on that envelope, sat right on the boundary of it.
That would be called an efficient portfolio. An efficient portfolio. However, and if you did find something out here, we would call it super efficient. Anything in here is called inefficient. However, okay, now, see that frontier right there? It's really kind of like theoretical to the extent that we can't get there exactly in practical, real life. We can't get there. We can get close to it, but we can't get there. These would be literally variations on a pure world portfolio. Every stock in the world in a portfolio, each stock in the portfolio has a weight of its contribution to the world economy. That'd be the kinds of things that you would get on the frontier. Now, we can get darn close to it. We can get really close with some index funds, like the S&P 500, that spider, you're pretty close. You are not on it. You're pretty close. Now, if you were to take my course, Investments 242, I show how responsible investment advisors, investment gurus, can get awfully close. One of the ways that they can do it is they take like a portfolio of portfolios. They take like three or four really efficient portfolios that are close to the boundary. And if you take that kind of a combined portfolio, you can get awfully close, awfully close. Any one of them is going to be close, but you put three or four of those really efficient portfolios together, and you're about as close as you'll ever get. So do know that there is a little bit of theoretical, can't do it in real life, in what we're going to do here next. However, I'm going to draw this again. And I'm going to sneak in that on the vertical axis is expected return against standard deviation. And I'm going to draw that efficient frontier. Now, you went to high school, right? You took algebra, right? Okay. Now, do you remember linear algebra? You look at me. Linear algebra? Okay, you do. Somewhere in your dark past, you all try to squeeze things in the way. You know, those bad childhood memories and all that. But there was something in that linear algebra That said, if you have 2 points, you can make a line. Okay? Any line is defined by just 2 points. Remember that one, there was one, y equals mx plus b, where you can, but you could say that m was, now you don't really need to write this, but yeah, y2 minus 1, 1 over x2 minus x1. And then you could do something, y minus y1 equals then y2 minus y1. And I'm not doing this. You won't have to do that this year. But there's a point. Bear with this. Okay. Oh, no, that's X. X minus X1. One way or the other. What I'm trying to get at is something that we know from algebra is that any 2 points define a line. So, is there a way we could get out here, sneak out here into this white space? As it were, maybe like breaking the speed of light by using a wormhole. Well, we could, at least theoretically, we could get a Markov portfolio. We can't in real life, but we could get awfully, awfully close. Okay, that's fine. But is there another way we can slip out here? Is there something else that could allow us to make a straight line and we could invest on the straight line? Well, actually, there is. See, I know that there is a riskless portfolio, a portfolio that has no variance in it. It's called treasury notes, or at least they're close to it. But you get only the return on that would be the risk-free rate. I can do that portfolio. It's not really even has nothing really to do with the efficient frontier. I can just buy a bunch of T-bills. They have no risk. They get me a lousy return, but at least I can plot that point. It is completely off the frontier of efficient investment, which means that I know there are two portfolios that are dual. There is a market portfolio right here that gets us the expected return to the market. And there is a risk-free portfolio. So if I were to say, okay, what if I just combine risk-free treasury bills with investments in the market portfolio? Well, I'll be darned. All I have to do is combine the market portfolio with treasury bills, and I can be anywhere on this line, completely jump the efficient frontier. That's what we do in finance. This line right here is called the capital market line. Now, this is something that I promise I'll put it on in a test. But there's another one called the securities market line. Make sure you write capital market line here, and you'll see in a minute why you should circle it or put a star and say, be careful. Okay, that's the capital market line. So in other words, we can actually ride on this super efficient portfolio. Combine the market portfolio with risk-free, or that would get us anywhere in here. Or we could borrow money and buy more of the market portfolio and get anywhere we want it out here. Okay, now let me turn that around. Here is what I'm about to draw here is called the securities market line. This is the graph of what we call the capital asset pricing model, CAPM. That's why you have to watch it, because the CAPM line is the securities market line. And the generic frontier line is the capital market line. It burns people every time I ask it. Try not to let it catch you. Capital market, the capital asset pricing model is the securities market line. Here's how it works. It's really simple. Let's just take an arbitrary metric. The market portfolio has a beta beat, beta, not B-E-A-T, B-E-T-A, of exactly 1. We just said that's our definition. We measure everything according to its performance against the market. So the market is a perfect one. We just say that. So now, in the securities market line, I am going to plot the betas of portfolios against the expected return to the portfolio. Okay. I got two points on this. First of all, the beta of exactly 1.00, that's the market portfolio, will get us exactly the expected return to the market. By definition, I mean, we're not doing anything mathematical, we're just saying beta of 1, the market portfolio, gets us the expected return to the market. It's not, there's nothing deep in that, we're just saying by definition. But we also know another point. We know that down here at a beta of exactly 0, you're going to get the risk-free rate. So there's a point right there on the securities market law. Treasury bills have no risk, so you're going to get nothing but the risk-free rate. Again, almost by definition, it's risk-free, so you get the risk-free rate. So those two are almost like duh, but what matters now is that we can connect these because two points make a line, and this is the securities market line. Stocks that are efficient, portfolios that are efficient, will park on this line. There shouldn't be anything above this, but there's going to be a hellacious amount of investment below it. In other words, inefficient investment, reflecting what happened over there on the underneath the frontier. So in other words, this is a securities market line. So you can say, okay, once I have this in place, I can say, well, what about a stock with a beta of, let's say, 1.25? Well, that would mean that that stock has an expected return right there. Well, what about a stock with a beta of 0.6? Well, that'd be about there, so we would expect its return to be right about there. That's all there is to it. Now, mathematically, this line I can write like this as an equation. The expected return to any stock or portfolio, whatever you want to talk about, investment, anything that has to do with putting money in at risk, is going to be equal to the risk-free rate. In other words, y-intercept, slope-intercept form, plus the beta of the portfolio times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. That's the capital asset pricing model. That's it right there. Now, I can actually show you with some quickie algebra how to get that from this right here, but it's not even worth it. It just, you take the 2 points, you got 1 point here at beta, if you plot betas against expected returns, you've got a point right here with a beta of zero, the expected return of the risk-free rate, and you've got a point out there with a beta of one that gets you the expected return to the market portfolio. And if you did the point-slope form of the equation and wound, twisted around, that's what would come out.
I don't do it anymore. I used to, but it's kind of like a not a very useful exercise. But you can get this. You know these 2 points on the security market line, so you can just do that point-slope form of the linear equation and rearrange it. That's what you get.
Practically speaking, it's really not that important, but the CAPM is huge. The original discoverers or creators of this were in the 1960s. At first it was thought that it was some kind of a speculative, well, this is kind of weird, does this really work? Even into the 1970s, there were some courts where there were arguments about the expected return to portfolios that rejected the CAPM, saying that it didn't make any sense. These were judges who had no background in mathematics or finance or anything, any hard sciences. But by the time we get to the 1980s, this became the gospel, and it is still there to this day. There have been other models that estimate the expected return of portfolios. There's one called the arbitrage pricing theory, APT, and a nasty, complicated thing that I teach in a derivatives course. But really, this is to this day how we do it. We want the expected return to a portfolio, to a stock, to an end project that we're going to take on. We use this to get it. Beta, now, where does the beta come from? You can look at, as you see, every time I pull up a stock, I can find the beta right away. Where does that beta come from? Oh, God, take my 341 or 242 class, and you can see where beta comes from. If you want to know, if you're that crazy, beta of a stock is equal to the average return to that stock. I'm sorry. I lied. It's the standard deviation of that stock over the standard deviation of the market portfolio times the correlation coefficient between that stock and the market. That's where it comes from. I mean, it can get a little hairy because historical data is what you would use, but we don't really want the historical beta. We want the forward-looking beta, but anyway, that's where it comes from. Now, practical terms. Practically speaking, the security market line is not static. It moves. It drifts. It can be made to do things. Now, for example, if all investors... Now, take this down because you're going to see these questions in your homework. And I could very well ask this on the final or on a quiz. A couple of things can move this line around. A couple of things. One would be if expected inflation goes up. Now, expected inflation infects everything. There's nothing that gets away from expected inflation. So in other words, expected inflation would make the risk-free rate go up because risk-free rate is the real rate plus expected inflation premium. It would also push up the market part, what investors would expect from the market portfolio. In other words, expected inflation would just cause everything to go up like that. The whole security market line would, as we say, translate upward. So in other words, if we had originally had, let's say, a beta of a stock of 0.4, so it would have had an expected return about here, okay? Now, if expected inflation kicks its head up, that would mean that that same portfolio would then have a higher expected return. So would stocks with high betas. This high beta stock out here would have a return originally like this, and then when expected inflation began to rage in, its expected return would go up. Know that one. A couple of others that you could be asked about. What happens if the Fed, trying to slow down the economy, raises the risk-free rate, but the market really doesn't care? So in other words, the Fed would raise the risk-free rate, let's say up to here, but the market portfolio will still be expected to return the same as it did before. So if the Fed did that, that would mean that the line, the securities market line, would pivot around the market portfolio. This is if the Fed raises the discount rate, but the market itself says that doesn't affect us, that's just short-term crap. That would mean that, watch this. This is an odd effect. Suppose we had this portfolio here, this low-risk portfolio. Originally, it had this expected return right here. But now, at the higher securities market line, it has a higher expected return. So in other words, this move would cause low-risk investments to improve their expected return. But on the other hand, look at this beta of the stock right here. That beta of that stock right there was originally there with the securities market line swinging the way it did. That high-risk stock will now have a lower expected return. Just draw this out a couple of times, and you'll see how you can just draw these lines and see what the reaction will be. And again, this is in your homework. And I know that can get confusing. Just go back to this and just draw the lines and see what happens. You could also do it if the risk-free rate, like the Fed is doing now. What if the risk-free rate is lower? What would that do? What would be the opposite effect of this? Okay. That is that part. Now, standard deviations aren't hard in itself. I mean, they can be a real pain if you actually have to do a standard deviation on your own. But just a little bit of notation, real quick. A little bit. Okay. Now, when I put an R with a bar over it, that is the average. That's the average. If I draw the average of your data, and if you want to look really fancy, you say that's a sum from I equals 1 to N of the return, individual returns, all divided by the number of data points you have. I mean, that's just fancy. Now, the standard deviation, the variance, sigma squared, that's the one that can get you into trouble. That one is an absolute pain in the butt. Now, this is a sample variance, which is probably what you're always going to use in most of your courses. The sample variance would be the sum from I equals 1 to N of each data point, each return, minus the average squared, all divided by N minus 1. On in Excel, STDEV is what you want to use, this function. Don't use STDEV.P because of the population. It'll get you the wrong answer because it divides by N, not N minus 1. That's the sample. Okay, now. We generally assume the stock returns are normally distributed. That's the mean, and a standard deviation if it's a normal distribution, about 67% of the data lies in this area. Two standard deviations either way, that's 95% of your data. This is just something from normal probability theory. Three standard deviations captures 99% of your data. It's just something without you. Keep in mind. We generally assume that stock prices, stock returns, are normally distributed. Unfortunately, that's probably not right. We have something, there's a term, and I was a little surprised your book brings it up. It's called the black swan events. Black swan event, you see a massive crash or a massive upswing would have a very low probability of happening in a stock. Maybe once every couple of centuries. Unfortunately, reality is that black swans happen more than once every couple of centuries. Especially on the downside, we've seen probably four black swans in the last century. In other words, it could not really happen if stocks really are normally distributed. Four events in one century would have a probability of occurring once in 100,000 years, and yet black swans happen a whole lot more often than that. So what that means is that for normal purposes, the normal distribution is fine. But if you want to get serious, the actual distribution is this doppelganger that was described mathematically described about 200 years ago. It looks like a normal, except it has fat tails. That would explain why we have black swans as often as we do. This thing, by the way, you don't need to know this, but it's called the Cauchy distribution. The Cauchy distribution has a really nasty little side part. It has an average, but it has no standard deviation. Because the tails are so fat, it never converges on a number. So the best models that are being used by the big, big investment houses actually numerically analyze stocks, not on the norm, like typical investors, small houses do. They do this, what requires a supercomputer, and they model on Cauchy. Just something to keep in mind. That's all I have for you. Go on.